You're listening to the Clean Comedy Podcast with James Creviston and Luke LaCoy.
All right, here we go. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Clean Comedy Podcast. It is just me, just James this week, but I have a great guest. But it's just me and no Danny, no Luke, and my guest asked me about that beforehand. Everybody knows Luke had a baby, Danny works late, so we had the perfect opportunity to talk to my guest and a good friend of mine, someone who I really look up to, who I think is an amazing comedian, and if he's not on Kevin Hart level at some point in his life, we're all being robbed of comedy. I just want everybody to know that because I honestly love him. He's like a brother to me. He probably doesn't feel the same way, or at least I hope he does, but he probably doesn't. But please welcome the very talented, the very funny, the very usually humble, but will put me in my place, Mr. Paul Douglas Moomjean.
Hi, what's your name again?
I told you. I knew you would. He does see.
No, Paul, thank you, James. This is wonderful. I think we've joked before. I have to be the guest that you've had on at least the most amount of hours.
I think that's true, actually. Yeah.
Right? Like that, I think, is a fact. I remember, I think, I was the first three-part episode you ever did. Mm-hmm. I remember we were recording it in your kitchen.
Yeah, in my apartment. Yeah, back in the day. Yeah. That's true. What's great about Paul and I, like our relationship, is that we have had this comedy journey at the same time and just like kind of growing or whatever. And Paul's been a little bit ahead of me the whole time. And it's been amazing to see all the things that you've got to do. It just like really blew me away. And you recently just had your Dry Bar special release, which is amazing.
Congrats. Took about 3 years to get it on, but we finally got it going. It survived, you know, VidAngel had that bankruptcy issue.
Right.
And that's not gossiping. I mean, that was email sent out to subscribers. And then after that issue, then of course the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And the other thing too, and this is just interesting for people who are listening about how these specials get made. I was maybe one of the top 20 that they first made, right? Because Jenna Kim Jones recommended me.
Yeah.
We met at your show. You're responsible. And if they would have asked me to put a special thanks, I would have put you.
Oh,
but they own the video, so there was no, you know, place where you put that. With that being said, when I did it about three and a half years ago, I have since then TV credits. Since then, I have better, you know, credits, better shows. I've done more headlining than featuring. But what they did is they went out and they got some top Christian comics. And they paid them some good money, which, you know, these people have followings, to try to boost up everything. Now, here's, you read my newsletter, I believe.
Yeah, the one for Flappers, yeah.
So the one that I wrote last was, people were asking about how this process worked. And I said, you know, for me, I feel so lucky that it took a while, because here's what happened. During the pandemic, they built up a stronger YouTube presence, a stronger Facebook presence. So now I have, within 48 hours of my clips dropping, each of them have over 50,000 views within 48 hours.
Yep.
And I'm going to say this, and this is where you talk about me being humble, but this is where I can be a little bit of a jerk.
Come on, do it.
I went back and I just prayed to God, please, God, don't let me be the lowest person on the totem pole.
You're not.
And, you know, when it comes to the amount of views and shared, And I found a lot of other comics that I'm not the biggest fan of their attitudes. And I was like, well, at least I surpassed so-and-so. And then I could, and I just, but you know what, to me, what I love about it the most is that I'm now in this same category as our heroes.
Yeah.
Right? So Jeff Allen, Robert G. Lee, the people that I saw growing up.
Dwayne Perkins has two specials on there. I love Dwayne Perkins. So like, yeah.
And knowing that I've worked with a lot of these comics, and that, you know, it's nice. I was telling, I actually did a show with Robert the other night, and I told Robert, I said, this is the last comic standing for this era of comics. when it comes to what a booker is looking for in a credit, the validation, all of those things. Yeah. So this is what's so exciting, is that I now have two YouTube clips that are 5 minutes long that I could submit to any festival. And that's just going to say, oh, he has a dry bar clip, and they're going to give it better attention than they would have had it been anywhere else.
Right.
And yeah. So that's a goal. That's an accomplishment. And so a lot of people are talking about, oh, well, what if, you know, you're going to make money off the clips? And I go, yes, but it may not be through dry bar. They have done more than enough for Paul Douglas Moonji, for them to put me on their platform, for them to give me a 30-minute special, for them to retweet and re-Instagram my story and re-Facebook me and everything else. They paid me for the special. I could not be happier with how it turned out. The only thing, you know, James, we were joking earlier, is how you were joking about how I look, and I've lost 55-60 pounds since that special.
Yeah, you're handsome. You're white. I always thought, like, oh, I'm Paul and I are just slightly different a little bit, but now you're like a 10 and I'm like a 7. I feel bad about myself. You're making me feel bad about myself.
It's the hair.
Love it. I love the hair.
For those who watch the YouTube clip, which I think your podcast gets a little better viewage than the YouTube, right?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah. So no one's going to see this hair, but this will encourage people to go watch. I've been writing some jokes about, because I shaved the beard.
Yeah.
And I shaved my beard and I'm growing it back because I still think it's a good look for me for comedy. But I was telling people, I said, I looked in the mirror and I thought to myself, oh God, when did I turn like into Newman from Seinfeld? And then that gets a laugh when I do it on stage, but then I'll talk about, I go, I kind of look like what Matt Damon would look like if no one cared about him. You know, just kind of, I look like a fat, sad Matt Damon. But I'm really happy with how everything turned out. We've been talking about this thing for the last 3-4 years since I got for it. And you know, it's funny, this morning I was able to have breakfast with our friends, the Verzi Triplets.
Yeah, I love those guys.
And I was talking to him about them, and they've been able to do Netflix stuff now, you know, with The Floor Is Lava. Talking about other people that came up around the same time as us, and you have this amazing podcast. And I have a dry bar special, and Joan Rivers had a great quote where they asked her, did all your friends make it? And she goes, all my friends made it who kept going.
Yeah.
And so when you look right now at all of us in that 5 to 10 year span, depending on how you want to frame the timeline, we all have found an area of comedy where we belong. We have all found a place where people want to put us on their platforms. People want to, you know, use us for different purposes. You have been able to become essentially the number one podcast on clean comedy.
Yeah.
The ability to bring in all of those great voices that you know, other comedy podcasts sometimes talk about other things, but you have stuck to comedy as a theme. It's been what a wonderful thing for comics to know is out there.
Yeah. Right?
You've had comedy writers, comedy performers, comedy comedians, you know, writers, all those things. So this is great. And so it's fun right now because we're watching those of us who stuck with it, you know, finding our place in comedy. And now we get to attack another level.
Yeah.
Right. So I know you're eager to get back on stage. You're going to get your Red Bar special one day. The Verzies and I were talking, they have goals for television. I have goals for writing and performing and corporate and stuff. So now we get to take those next level. Now that we've built these platforms for ourselves, this is the, you know, when you read those books about LA comedies, like this is the, we're in chapter 6.
Yeah.
We're not in chapter 1 anymore. And that's a wonderful feeling.
It's a great feeling. And it's also, it takes time to grow. It takes time to find your thing. It takes time to find your voice. And like, that's the hardest part of getting started as comedy is most people, their first year of comedy is doing jokes just like everyone else, right? All their jokes sound the same. Their Tinder jokes, their date jokes, their whatever jokes they are. And then suddenly something clicks. If you stand up long enough and you go, oh, that's my voice. This is the thing that people always laugh at. This is the thing that people always find out about me. What I like about you is you're so honest about who you are. And even here's my only sad part about watching the special is guys like you and me, I don't know if that's a joke you could do anymore. Is it?
You know what, James? This is where, like, you know, I yell at you in this very fun, brotherly way. but you also are someone who picks up on something quicker than anybody else. And I can't do the joke anymore.
Oh. For
those listening, I do a joke where I talk about how a 400-pound man looked at me after I lost, and I changed the weight depending on where I am in my journey. And they go, you know, guys like you and me. And then I'll look at some thin guy in the audience, and I go, that's offensive, right, sir? Especially to guys like you and me. He always gets a laugh. It always does really well. Well, for the last month and a half, you know, because we last had me on the show was right after I got out of the hospital.
Yeah.
If you remember, I was supposed to do the show.
Yeah.
And I ended up checking into the hospital. And I had the massive heart disease, and I've lost a bunch of weight since then. And by the way, just to report to those who do listen and care, heart has made a full recovery.
Awesome.
I just did a second echo, which is where they put gel on your chest and they pull a camera, and it's the world's worst movie. And it's like,
that's a colonoscopy.
Yeah, it's the worst Pixar movie of all time. It's like Inside Out, but just inside, you know. Or Soul. I don't know. It's one of those
Soul. Movies. It's definitely Soul. Yeah.
And so here's what happened. Things are good, but I physically have lost a lot of weight, and I've changed physically how I present myself to the world. I'm sure you kind of noticed that immediately.
Yeah.
There is a, because here's the thing too, because of the heart thing, I had to give up drinking. I had to give up smoking cigars. I had to give up a lot of things that were the vices in my life. I'm sleeping at a better regular rate now. I am, because I've been able to, really focus on my health, I'm not anxious about comedy stuff. Well, that's coming out of my comedy. It's changing my point of view.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is I'm becoming a different kind of comedian because I have new complaints.
That's interesting.
The sweaty, nervous, fun energy, that's gone. And people are not accepting me making fat jokes. I can make Bakersfield jokes. I can kind of talk about how maybe in another part of the state I'm more attractive or this or that, and people kind of still go with that. But nobody's believing that I have problems with women or finding a job or any of those things.
I told you.
No, we would hire you. We wouldn't hire the fat guy. We like the fat guy. We would hope the fat guy comes to Thanksgiving, but this new guy you're presenting, you know, I feel it. There's a different, and I know it's a clean show, but there's a sexual energy that I have been able to develop out there that I feel myself. Not, I don't feel myself.
But, yeah.
My point is that I've had more women approach me. I've had more people talk to me about, like, you know, stuff that wasn't happening 55, 65. And even when I used to be this way, I was still drinking. I was still smoking. So the positive energy that's stemming from a person who's getting regular sleep and feeling good and feeling healthy and has a new lease on life, it hurts the comedy a little bit because there's less conflict, but it's forcing me to go deeper.
That's the
benefit. I'm starting to go, okay, well, let's talk about the insecurities from a different point of view.
Yeah. Could you imagine though, like you and I would have the same problem. Like, there's no way I can't get a date jokes. I can't get whatever. Like, there's no way we could get away with that because we look a certain way, and that's just, it's weird. You know, there's some people who can totally get away with that, right? If you, there that we know that can do that joke all day long, no problem. Totally believe them. You know, if we say, oh, life has got us down, they're gonna like, what's wrong with you, this guy? Like, you know, it's like when a hot girl does those kind of jokes, I'm like, really? Come on, we don't believe. Like, that's just the problem. It's a weird thing that comedy is so much about how you look, not only what you say, but mostly about how you look, because people look at you and judge you the moment you get on stage, and then you have to either take, like, lean into those, or you try to subvert it, and that doesn't always go well either.
Which is, you know, I still run the School of Flappers, and that's still what I teach my level one students.
Yeah.
It's the minute you walk on stage, you know, I've had students who are very heavy or very tall, and they don't want to make a joke about that.
Yeah.
I tell them, I go, one joke acknowledging where you are physically is all you need to do to get the audience to jump on board with you,
yeah,
or at least to see how you see yourself.
Yeah.
I'm
working on the Dry Bar special for myself. And my opening joke is about having a dad bod, because you look at me and you realize this dude has a dad bod. He's not I'm not the fit guy I used to be. I'm not the guy that I was when I was in the Navy. I don't have a six pack. I have a dad bod. I'm a dad. So it works. And then we go from there.
Right. And what it allows also is for all of your jokes to have this kind of telescope to look through.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you're honest with yourself, the audience can then be, oh, relaxed and go, oh, this person knows who they are. That's fine. I can't tell you how many times I've seen guys talk about like, oh, I'm dating all these women, and it's so unbelievable.
Yeah.
Right. And you kind of go, I don't think you are. You know, I was working with a student, mom, doing mom jokes, but she's like in perfect shape. And she was wearing clothes that moms aren't traditionally known for wearing.
Right.
Not that she was wearing anything inappropriate. It was just she still has a 25-year-old body at 40.
Right.
Her jokes weren't hitting. And I said, well, think about this. It sounds like you've kind of made up these kids. Because most moms are kind of going, I can't believe you have two kids and you look like that. Right. I said, you may want to just readjust how you present yourself on stage. She told me that her jokes started landing more because it wasn't a distraction. Whereas on the opposite angle, I've had single women talking about dating men, and those students, I said, hey, maybe dress a little bit more, kind of showing off that the fact that you're still in great shape so we understand what type of men would probably come hit on you. And they told me that was more effective.
Yeah.
So as much as we don't want to believe that physically that's going to determine how jokes are going to work, that's not if you watch a sitcom, what makes a sitcom work is when Kevin James makes a joke about how he's just as good looking as his wife, which is so false.
Right.
And so but if he looks like Tom Selleck and says that, it's not a joke. It's truth.
Yeah.
When he says it, but we have to be honest about what we look like, and we have to be honest and we have to present ourselves the way we want the audience to see us. So, you know, there's a couple new things that I'm doing clothes-wise. You know, that's something that I'm tapping into. I'm wearing Muppet shirts, and I'm joking about the fact that I'm single and wearing a Muppet shirt, which once you wear a Muppet shirt at 40, people go, oh, yeah, he's single.
Yeah. Or he has kids, hopefully. But if he doesn't, right, he's definitely single.
Right,
yeah.
Right, but he's at least single. Or he's a dad.
Yeah.
And when I say I'm single and people are kind of like, oh, come on. And I go, oh, but they see the Muppet shirt. They go, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? Like, we always think, at least most people who think about comedy, they always think like, oh, I have to have these perfect jokes and then people will laugh. But that's not even 90% of it. Like, a lot of it is what is not said, what is seen by you. Like, could you imagine if Jerry Seinfeld dressed like a slob and then did his jokes? They wouldn't land the same way. They would. No. That's why he wears a suit. That's why he dresses that way. If Chris Rock, when his early days, didn't have the leather jacket and strut the stage and talk the way he talked, like, he gave off the persona. Like, you know, Chris Rock probably's not going to win a fight, but he gave off the persona like he could win a fight, right?
Right. In fact, I would argue that Jerry Seinfeld dressing in a suit and complaining about the size of toothpaste makes sense. This is a person who is about efficiency.
Yeah.
And if he wore a flannel shirt and jeans and complain, it would be weird. He would look like someone who doesn't care about that stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So yes, the way we dress, the way we present ourselves, the physical fitness level. In fact, Dave Chappelle was recently on Joe Rogan trying to defend himself a little bit. And he said that he had to stop lifting weights because it was getting ridiculous and it was causing confusion in his jokes.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a point there. Like, Dave Chappelle was willing to decrease his muscle mass to make his jokes more effective.
Well, yeah, because when you first saw Dave Chappelle, when he was doing Chappelle's Show, all that stuff back in the day, he looked like a skinny crackhead. He got away with that. That's his shtick. He's that skinny, weird-looking guy, right? And then he got jacked, and you're like, what is going on here? Why is he – he can't weed jokes from a dude that's 250 pounds of solid muscle, that's not going to work. You're not going to sell that joke. You know?
And it's a different set of complaints that are believable now.
Yeah. So yeah, now he complains about money, and he complains about your family, and he complains about, you know, being a star, whatever. Like, okay, now we get it. We 100% are on board with that. What, right, wrong, otherwise, whatever people think about it. But those are the things he complained about. If he's talking about, like, man, I can't find weed today, you're like, really? You can't? You of all – you? Come on, dude. Like, people probably give it to you every day. you know.
Yes, people probably do. I think when you reach a certain level of fame, you never have to pay for a drug ever.
Right, yeah. And sorry to anybody not offending you by drugs, but I'm just saying, like, if you think about different comedians, that'd be the same thing for Joe Rogan saying the same thing. But we know who he is, too. He recognizes, I'm a giant ape, right? That's all. That's his shtick.
Right? 5'5", giant ape.
Yeah. I mean, but he'd still knock my head off.
I met him once at the Improv. He wouldn't know me, but we were walking by, and I thought, I think I'm an inch and a half taller. And I was so proud of myself. This is my greatest accomplishment in comedy, to be an inch and a half taller than Joe Rogan.
I saw Vin Diesel in real life one time and realized how short he was. And I was like, really? That's the guy that everybody's scared of? Like, I'm not scared of him anymore.
Not The Rock, according to the trade papers.
Yeah, The Rock's definitely not scared of him. But I would be scared of The Rock. Although I feel like The Rock would, like, bear hug you and then break your ribs on accident. You know what I'm saying?
I wouldn't be, but that's because The Rock stunt double is an old family friend of mine.
Oh wow, okay.
Tunnel Y. Reed, who just won the Hollywood Reporter Stunt Man of the Year.
Awesome.
Been working with him for the last, I don't know, 15 years or so, at least since The Rundown, I think. So I've known that caliber of people for a long time, of the large size Samoan men. But also The Rock wouldn't scare me the same way, because The Rock is so cool.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you almost feel like you could go to The Rock and get a picture, and he feels like he's having fun.
Yeah, that's true. And that's what I like about The Rock, too, is that he's that kind of guy. I just feel like The Rock is so strong that, like, he doesn't realize how strong he is sometimes. So, like, he might hug you, and then when he does it, when he lets go, you're like, I got to go to the chiropractor now. You know, like, and it was a soft hug, too. It was like the bro hug, but still.
I'm going to throw a kink in your armor there. As a professional wrestler, he has to know.
That's true.
Right? So, like, he's a professional hugger.
Yeah.
Because that's what professional wrestling is. It's a lot of hugging.
Yeah.
I mean, it's violent hugging. There's a lot of punching to the face in the hugging.
Yeah. That's true. I love that. And I think that's the biggest thing that comedians forget about or they go on stage and go, I can wear whatever I want and then talk about whatever I want. It's like, yes and no, right? That should be the goal. That is, right, what we want to do. But there's a persona that everybody comes to. You prejudge every person you meet the moment you see them, before a word comes out of their mouth. And then when they say something, you judge them again, right? You might see somebody be like, that guy looks stupid. And then he says something and he's the most intelligent person in the world. Like, well, I'm an idiot. You know, like that, right. That everyone does that. And so that's the same thing with comedy. I wonder how much of your set you have had to remove from because of the changes in your life, and then how much new material have you written since then? Like, what's kind of the ratios there?
Well, I have. So the jokes that don't hit as much are just the fat jokes.
Okay.
But all the single stuff, when I talk about dating different age groups, since I'm kind of talking about the personality types of how women change over the years, that's a truth regardless of how handsome the date is, the man. The two closing bits for the special, the one about me going to Arizona, I think still works regardless of what I look like. And I haven't done that in a long time. It was fun to get to watch that again with a live audience and watch that, how that played out. And then the bit that actually was the thing that kind of propelled me into for a while I was doing really well in festivals and doing really well in a contest, about the bit about the guy who asked if I have Down syndrome.
Yeah.
That's not going to hit anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not going to
work. So I can't do that. But at the time when I was 270 pounds and my earlobes were attached to the bottom of my neck, yes, you get to ask that question in the comment section of an online show. And then I get to now play in that, you know, kind of comedy world. Today that wouldn't work. Nobody would ask that question.
Yeah.
So really, ironically, my closing bit, the one that was winning me multiple comedy contests. I mean, I made money off that bit, real money. Got to the finals of big, you know, I got to a finals of an improv comedy contest at Melrose. I got to the Ventura Harbor contest. And there was one more, I forget which one, but I mean, I was doing really well with that bit. That bit does not exist today.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But that's fine, because that's a nice evolving, you know, thing about comedy is it's good to retire a bit.
So how much of the special do you perform now? Like, would you say 50%, 30%? Like, what's the ratio there?
15%.
15. And then, so you've, yeah. have you, how much more material have you written since? Well, because that special didn't come out yet.
I could easily do a completely different 30-minute special tonight.
That's awesome.
As I talk more about, I actually have some stuff that I would do. I have some tags that I've built off of that material that I can now actually turn to its own joke. So over time, while I was waiting for the special to come out, I was just continuing to do certain jokes. And since then, I built it. Now, here's what I will say. I'm still very clean, but I definitely do more edgier things because my life has changed dramatically. You know, when I was writing those specials as a Bible college professor, as a Christian high school AP English teacher, and as a wrestling coach. My life was much more clean. Since I wrote that special, I have become, for a time there, I was the pageant host for all Hooters bikini contests. I have gone through two massive heart situations, diabetes attacks. So I have different health concerns I've had in my life. I've gone out, when I wrote that special, it was about a year after breaking up with a girl that I thought I was gonna marry. And so my dating life has changed dramatically since then. So I've gone into a different world in which I can still write things with no profanity, nothing graphic sex, but it's definitely edgier. And the people I hang out with, it's a more edgy thing. So my humor now is still clean, but there's definitely a new edge to it. And so that to me, you know, if Drybar wanted to do another special, I'd love to do it. Yeah. If not, that's fine. You know, they got a million comics out there. But I have a whole new 30, 40 minutes of material since this came out. Yeah. And I'm very proud of that. I probably, with what my goal is probably in the next year to finally, you know, put another special together.
Yeah.
And then now that I've already seen a jump in my TikTok, I've seen a jump on my Facebook, I've seen a jump on my YouTube. I got to start creating new content because I was kind of living off of, I don't know, a few 50, 60 subscribers. And I just jumped to almost 100, so 50 people went to find me on YouTube. And luckily I had a bunch of clips already there.
Yeah.
I got to start producing some new stuff. So now that's my job now is the December is to start beefing that up now that I have new people. And then hopefully they're sharing that. And the joy of Drybar is hopefully people are going, oh, I follow this comic from Drybar. You should follow him too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the truth is you got to have content. That's what I love about having, my YouTube, I think YouTube is less than 1,000 subscribers on mine, but that's okay. It's like, all right, someday when stuff starts popping, they'll have plenty of stuff to watch. I'm not going to be upset about it. So it'll be good.
But you're also doing really well within the non-visual portion.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, that's always great. That's a very well doing thing. It just, I am working on a lot of things at one time. And the goal is, I'm hoping that things will open up soon so I can do more things as I really need to work on this half hour. I've had some of it finessed, some of it worked out. I've done stuff on Zoom. I work on it almost weekly with Robert G. Lee on stuff. So I'm working on things. It's just now getting up and doing that half hour, you know, three or four times and then being like, okay, here it is. We're ready to go. That's
right. That to me was, and here's something I get to say now that it's out, nobody knows. I've never done, I shot about 38 minutes. They decided to turn all the specials into under 30 now.
Yeah.
So I did about 38 to 40 minutes. It might've been a little under 40, but here's what I'm going to say. I had never done that much time in my life of quality material. So everything that I did in that special was the first time it had ever been put together at that length.
How did you prepare then? Like if you couldn't do the whole half hour or 38 in one time, how did you?
I literally was doing 7 to 8 minute spots. And what I would do is try to book as many as I possibly could.
Okay.
And I ran, I think, one 20 minute set in the Yoohoo room at Flappers. So I had to pick 20 minutes I wanted to do. And then what I did was, is I went, I knew certain, I didn't have to run the Down syndrome bit.
Right.
Because I'd done that so much, I just knew that I was going to close with that. So it didn't matter. Okay. Now, some people would have said, but how do you know that was going to work with everything else you were doing?
Right.
Because here's why. Everything else I was doing, I would do a pocket of that, and then I would do Down syndrome to close out all my shows. Oh. So I always wanted to, so I always knew that everything always worked well with it.
Okay. That's so smart.
Right? But here's the other thing, too, is I was a natural public speaker. I mean, I used to do presentations for people who were coming out of jail and out of prison through this PAC program when I used to be a marketing director for a for-profit technology school at ITT Tech. I talk about it in the special. So I would go and do these big presentations and motivational speeches and different things. So the idea of doing 30, 40 minutes didn't scare me. I've done that many times in my life. I've had chapels. I've taught in churches. So doing all that is easy. But I had to get all of the material down so that I knew how long each one was. So if I knew I was going to do, you know, be dating 20-year-olds to 40-year-olds, I knew that I was going to have to do something on current jobs. I was going to have to do something on old jobs. So then putting it all together, that was a risk. And I will say that the first tape we did was not as good as the second one. Whereas the person I did my special with, they had two comics that night, his first one just hit like nobody's business. And the second one was a little bit more spotty. And so we kind of reversed our success that night. So it's not that more practice necessarily makes it better. More practice just lets you know what may or may not connect.
Gotcha.
Or at least the order of things. And so when you watch the special, it kind of is the story of Paul.
Yeah.
It kind of moves through my life. Right. So that's kind of what I did there is I decided that was the easiest way for me to do the four because I'm a storyteller.
Yeah.
And I'm a natural storyteller. And I love telling people about wrestling. I love telling people about my jobs. I love calling my friends, my family and saying, this is what happened to me today. And that's so that naturally worked with how I chose to do that special. Today, I might do it a little differently. Today might look more like a traditional special of topic to topic,
right?
As opposed to narrative.
I like narrative though. That's what makes me like people like Chris Titus and stuff. It's like a narrative story feels good to me. Mike Birbiglia's specials are very narrative driven and stuff, a story of a event or a process. And I like that kind of stuff. I think that's the best way to go because then people get to see who you are and weave that whole piece in there. So I don't mind that, but I do get what you're saying. Like a Chris Rock special is topic to topic to topic to topic, right? You know, Jerry Seinfeld topic, topic, topic. So I can see both ways. Did you have your set list on the stool or next to you or somewhere where you can see it
in case
you got lost?
I teach how to use a set list. I don't believe it.
Really?
I don't.
I always take a set. I write my set list five times. It's my compulsion. I write it five times before a show, and then I put it in my pocket, and it always goes on the stool next to me. I've never had to use it. I've never had a problem, but it's for me, it's like a comfort thing, I think.
So, some comics I've heard you have a set list. You kind of know what you want to do, rip it up, and you know. Other people they methodically like to move through jokes. For me, what I found was. Every time I brought a set list up on stage, I now was treating it like it was the teacher in me or the AP student in me that now I have to get through that list or I didn't accomplish my goal. The goal of comedy is not to get through all the jokes.
Right.
The goal of comedy is to make the audience laugh. So what a set list can do to me, this is why I don't like it, is if I thought I'm going to write one or two jokes about what happened at the supermarket, right? And how they treated me at the supermarket. And I'm going to talk about how mad I am about the supermarket. If I'm getting big laughs off that, I need to now continue that. If I don't want to just end that and go to, okay, well, I'm glad you like those two jokes. Now we're going to talk about dating. Okay. I would rather when I do a show and I'm trying something new, I like to think to myself, let's go and explore all the places we can. If this is connected, if it's not, I got to throw it out.
Right.
And so the other night, I'll give you an example. The other night, I did a show in which the average age of the audience was 172.
Wow.
Yeah. So
200-year-olds in there?
There were 300-year-olds in there. I did one Bumble joke. Then I had to explain what Bumble was. Then I realized it's time to move on. So so when you're working with a crowd that is just, you know, at some point as the comedian, if I go by the set list, yeah, I have 10 more jokes about Bumble. Well, I didn't know what the audience was going to be. And to be perfectly honest, I don't like judging an audience up front and going, old people don't. For all I know, these people are all on Bumble and it's all Bumble dates. How do I know? I mean, Bumble could go up to 100 years old. So I give them the benefit that they are engaging in the culture until I find out they're not.
Right. That makes sense.
Find out they're not. Then I have to go, okay, you know what they're going to like? They're really going to like about at least the dating stories that didn't go well, but they're not going to like anything about when I'm joking about what I do on Bumble or the type of women I'm matching with.
Right. But I mean, for the special though, wouldn't having a set list be beneficial because you know you've already, you know the time frame on that. So it's kind of like helps you plan it out.
There's nothing in front of me.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't like the crutch. I don't like that. I don't want to look at it and then ask myself, did I do everything I was supposed to do?
Right.
Because comedy is still in the moment.
Yeah.
So as much as we have, like, again, it would be irresponsible for me not to know that I'm moving from this topic to this topic to this topic. But if by some chance I throw something out psychologically in the moment, it could just be I realize that's not going to click tonight.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but that's why it's important not to do one of, like, I was only a few years into comedy when I recorded this special. Most people should be 7-8 years in, where at least they have things in their head. You know, the other night it was funny. I was connecting, but I wasn't connecting completely. And so I decided to do a really old bit that just came into my head about horror movies, and it just killed, and they just loved it. And the old men in the back were clapping, and the young people were clapping, and everybody just loved it. And so somehow, with no plan of doing that bit, as I sat there talking to them about movies, I went, you know, let me do the horror bits. I mean, now I would have loved to have done that one in the special, but I wrote that one like 3 months after I filmed it.
Right.
Yeah. So
I actually can't do my serial killer bit in the special. I've already talked to somebody about it, so that's not gonna fly. I wish I could.
Do what?
My serial killer bit.
Yeah. Know, no, the Mormons are not fans of serial killers.
No, they're not. Even, never mind. I'm not gonna go there. Never mind. Keep going.
but had I in that moment, when I was the other night, had I gone, no, I have a set list, I wouldn't have had that Halloween horror film joke come out. And that's a good 2-3 minutes that they really enjoyed. So in the moment of being on the stand-up stage, I could read the audience well enough to go, these people don't want to hear about my other problems.
Right.
Sometimes they do want to hear about your problems. And sometimes right, they want to hear about the way you see the world. And it's your job as a comic that as you begin, you should have a couple of opening jokes that should be a good barometer of how the audience is going to respond to you.
Yeah.
I think that's a mistake that a lot of comics make, is they go, no, I have all these jokes that I want to do. I wrote all these jokes. And you go, well, that's great, but that then go be a sitcom writer where the script is forced.
Yeah.
Because there's a laughing sign, and you can go back and you can pepper in a laughing track, and you can do all the things to fix. But in real life, there's no laughing track.
Yep.
In real life, you're up there on the stage, vulnerable. And if you can't make that switch, then that booker, those other comics are not going to want you to be on their next show.
Yep, exactly.
Because they're going to go, this guy doesn't read the room.
Yeah, that's true. And yeah, there's a lot of times where I've had some of my best sets where, yeah, I had the set list, but then I riffed because something was funny. And I just kept riffing on that. And then it was like, oh, now I have a new tag. Now I have a new punchline. Now I have a new whatever for this bit. And it's grown from there. So I get that. I would just be so nervous to do, because I filmed a thing for, it's like for a reality TV show that's going to do like stand-up comedian type thing. I got paid to go do it a couple months ago, and I literally wrote out my set list 5 times, and then I took it up there, and I was nervous. Like, I'd done a bunch of Zoom shows, I'd done a bunch of like a live show app things and like whatever, but I hadn't been on stage, and that, for some reason, waiting, I was like fourth or fifth, I think, going up. Waiting, I got more and more nervous. I'm like, why am I doing this again? Why? What's going on here? And then I got on stage and went away. I said the first joke, the first line, the setup and punchline, boom, everyone laughed. And I was like, oh, we're here. Let's go. And like having the set list, like, I don't know, gave me that comfort of like, okay, I know what I'm going to talk about. And it went really well. I was very happy with how it went. They were happy with how it went. The crowd loved it. I was like, okay. And I got off stage and I was like, oh my gosh, I can still do this. Like, I'm okay. You know, it was a terrifying moment.
Yeah. You know, not that you should be equally nervous at a certain point in your career, right? But you should always be a little nervous. You should always be a little anxious. You should always be a little excited. And, you know, I coached wrestling for years. And one day I'm going to write a book. I will. I don't know when. I'm going to write a book called Everything I Learned in Life, I Learned from Coaching Wrestling.
That's a good book.
And it's a great title, I think.
Yeah.
Everything I Learned in Life, I Learned from Coaching Wrestling. And I would apply it to the different areas of my life, whether it be marketing, running the schools, education, life, dating, everything. Yeah. And what I learned was any athlete who's not a little bit nervous before the match always lost in the first 30 seconds.
Interesting.
But they didn't care. And I remember there was a guy that I coached that really bothered me because he would just be like sitting down and be like, hey, man, let's warm up. And I would be like, no, let's warm up. Let's get ready. Let's, you know, you excited for this? And I was like, I don't really care if I win or lose. I really don't care anymore. And then he thought that by not caring, it would present him with the ability to like beat the guy out of some type of odd, I don't know, apathy victory. And he would just get, what he would do is he would grab the guy's head, he'd grab his arm, he'd try to throw him to his back, get rolled to his own back, and then get pinned every time.
Yeah.
But I had another wrestler who won a CIF championship who was not a great athlete. And he was so nervous. And I remember always telling him right before every match, we've beaten better than this guy, which we had had. And, you know, 90% of the guys weren't as good as the guys he beat before. So he always reminded himself, oh, that's right. But it was that nervousness that provided him with enough fear to take on the challenge.
Yep.
So I think as an athlete or as a performer, you have to have that same energy on some level.
Yeah.
Because also I think when you see a comedian not caring or not trying, it's because if there's no risk in the actual performance, they're not going to give it their all.
Yeah. And it's probably a skill I learned when I did MMA too. I played baseball, football, whatever, going, but MMA was a time where I would get nervous. I was like, these other people are training in the same skill that can kill other human beings just like me. And some of these guys are in the UFC. So every time I would get nervous, and afterwards they would always say things like, man, you really did a good job. Like, you really went out there and gave it your all. And I was like, this is a dude that's in the UFC that I just traded blows with that said nice things about me. Like, I felt better about myself afterwards. Like, oh, I can do this. And that's the same way with comedy. It's like people come up and say, oh, man, that was so funny. You're so funny, whatever. I'm like, in the moment, I'm terrified. I'm like, this is the worst thing I've ever done in my life. Why am I doing this? But I think you're right. The fear. And even Tom Papa said to me, like, if you're not a little bit nervous when you go on stage, you're doing something wrong, because you should have a little bit of fear. Like, and that you said the same thing. It's like that little bit of fear is enough to get you there. Like, okay.
Now, the other night I actually had a show where the first two comics bombed. Oof. Hard. Now, you know, I went through a little slump in about a month where nothing was clicking. And maybe it was because I did the jokes too long. I don't know. But there was two comics that bombed, and basically the producer looked at me and just kind of went, good luck, as I walked up there. Like, this crowd is not respect. And I took it as a fun challenge.
Yeah.
So actually I wasn't even nervous, because there's no way I could do worse.
Yeah.
But I saw it as a challenge to make them laugh. And that's ended up being a really fun show. And I ended up getting a really great response. And a lot of people came up afterwards and talked to me, and they really enjoyed it. And the other comics started, in fact, two comics who wouldn't follow me on Instagram before followed me on Instagram. That's a nice compliment.
Yeah.
But that's another thing too, is that you can be excited for it, which is the same good energy as sometimes being nervous. But yeah, I think that's very important, is that you should care.
Yeah, yeah, you definitely have to care. Well, Paul, where can people find you? Where can they find the special? Where can they get to know you and stuff? All that kind of stuff.
My website, my Twitter, and my Instagram and my TikTok are all The Moom Abides. The Moom Abides. Obviously, the website.
I'll put it in the show notes. Yep.
The Dry Bar special is out right now. It's called Guys Like You and Me, which is great to have a catchphrase that I'll never get to do again.
I know. That's so sad.
But Guys Like You and Me is wonderful, wonderfully produced, and it's a lot of fun. I've had a lot of people watch it. They said their kids liked it too. So, you know, it's all family friendly. But yeah, Dry Bar, it's on the app and it's on the website. So you just go to drybarcomedy.com or drybarcomedy app, and you can just download. It's a trial run. You can use the promo code Paul Moomjean. That's PaulMoomJean. Use a promo code, and that'll help them know that I recommended the special, and that's good for their analytics too.
Perfect. Yeah, I'll put all that in the show notes so everybody can click on it, and they'll have the link, and then they can put in the stuff for the trial as well so we can help you out. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Paul. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please like, subscribe. Please go check it out on YouTube so you can see how handsome Paul is. Again, I'm a 7. He's a 10. We see what's going on. I'm worried he's going to steal my wife now, so I got to be careful. So thank you again. Thank you, everybody. Have a good one, and bye.
Bye.